The Lord be in my mind and in my heart and on my lips. And the Lord be with you. A reading from the good news of the Holy Gospel according to John. There was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had likewise been invited to the celebration. At a certain point, the wine ran out. And the mother of Jesus told him, "They have no more wine." And Jesus replied, "Woman, how does this concern of yours involve me? My hour has not yet come." His mother instructed those waiting on table, "Do whatever he tells you." As prescribed for Jewish ceremonial washings, there were at hand 6 stone water jars, each one able to hold 15 to 25 gallons. "Fill those jars with water," Jesus ordered, at which they filled them to the brim. "Now," he said, "draw some out and take it to the waiter in charge." They did as he instructed them. The waiter in charge tasted the water made wine without knowing where it had come from. Only the waiters knew, since they had drawn the water. And the waiter in charge called the groom over and remarked to him, "People usually serve the choice wine first. Then, when the guests have been drinking a while, a lesser vintage. What you have done is keep the choicest wine until now." Jesus performed this first of his signs at Cana in Galilee. Thus did he reveal his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This is the good news, the gospel of the Lord. If you had, as many of us in this parish do, taken a sacred pause during the week to look at these scripture readings which have just now been proclaimed, to see what nourishment they might give you, if you had done that and further you began to wonder what the homily might be this Sunday, especially those of you who are long-standing members of the parish and polite and attentive listeners to the preacher, you probably would have considered it a good guess. He's going to grab that first line from the first reading for sure. "I will not be silent. I will not be silent until the holy city is reality for all God's people." You kind of knew I'd say that. And part of the reason would be because if you were paying any attention at all, you realize this would be the Sunday for us to acknowledge that prophet in our own time, Dr. King. And if you'd gone further and looked at the second reading, the more experienced you might be with the life of this parish, you might say you had to know. We'd at least draw your attention to the powerful underlying and overriding message there. You are gifted. No. Don't tell me you weren't born to preach. Don't tell me you weren't born to teach. Don't tell me you're afraid of crowds. However you are, however you're made up, whatever you in your uniqueness may be, God has gifted you to be you and to bring something special to God's wondrous plan of salvation in a way that only you could ever do. You knew I'd say that. You knew that it is bedrock to our faith, to our sense of community, to our understanding of the good news. Each and every person here is gifted and has a gift to give that no one else can give. The apostle puts it so simply. Okay, some people can talk in tongues, and then there are other people who can interpret them. Some people are born to get up in front of a crowd and mouth off. Others, by their very nature, have a special gift to work quietly, silently, behind the scenes to get good things done. But of this, all the people can be assured and affirmed, every single one of God's people, the strong, the weak, the young, the old, the handsome, the homely, the educated, the unlettered, each and every one of God's people is uniquely gifted to make the prophecy come true. Now, if you went further in your scriptural deliberations earlier in the week, you might well have said, ha, 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 what's he going to do with this? The gospel, the marriage feast of Cana. Will he just touch lightly on those first two and then talk about marriage and family? It could be a homily on Mary, great primal symbol of the church, who implores Jesus and gets him, as it were, even to act against his own judgment. But I was forewarned by the scholars and the experts to try to take that gospel and tie it in with the other theme that jumped out at me first would be probably vain and at best somewhat contorted. So I let go of that, and I decided for this particular occasion, given this commingling of messages and moments, to be satisfied just with that one delightful poetic teasing line of the gospel. You saved the best wine to the last. And I saw immediately how that particular line takes on an added poignancy when you relate it to this celebration of a prophet in our time, because I can assure you, as fellow preacher, that Dr. King had to know, whenever and wherever he preached, the best wine was being saved till last. He knew in his heart that he would not live to taste the ultimate cup. Indeed, that his own blood might be spilled, like wine wasted, before the cup of the kingdom would be passed around. He knew that. And knowing that God had forewarned him through all the prophets who preceded him that the best wine would only be tasted in the kingdom, as Jesus said at the Last Supper, it gave Martin strength to go on, even into the darkness. My focus is on the call of the prophet, and to try in my own way in your midst this day to say not that you all should be preachers or interpreters of tongues or public persons, but to challenge you in the spirit of this day's liturgy and with this powerful example of a fallen prophet in our own day, to say to you, God is calling you to say from the very depth of your being, I will not be silent. I will not be a spectator to salvation history unfolding. I will, in the unique way given to me, I will be witness to the truth. I'll be part of this proclamation. I will not be silent until the kingdom comes. It is in the intimacy, the unique intimacy of your relationship with God, which no one else, even your lover, can fully enter. It is in that uniqueness that the depth of your gift and giftedness must be found. And it is your vocation, your call as prophet, you, the prophet you are, to find the way, to be in spirit at one with Isaiah. Your life as you live it, your gospel as you experience it, your witness as you proclaim it, must somehow contribute to the great echo, the resounding echo of all the prophets before you and with you, saying to the world, we will not be silent in the face of injustice, of unjust arrangements, of structures and plans and contortions that victimize some while enhancing and making great comfort for others. We will not be silent in the face of that. In our own bold and loud and resounding way, or in our quiet, unnoticed way, we will be, with Isaiah, one in spirit, not in silence, but in action. Now, you could easily have wondered, had a thought, maybe guessed wisely and rightly, what the homily might be this morning because of the texts right there in the three readings. And knowing, as every American does, that this would be the Sunday to meet our national celebration of Dr. King. But probably few, if any of you, knew that the preacher would be coming to this liturgy shaken, reanimated, lifted up again in the last few days by being in the company of Haitians and advocates for the Haitian people at a national conference in Washington. Then, if you knew that, you could guess where we'd be going in this morning's celebration. For our Haitian sisters and brothers, and their situation, their condition, is a perfect paradigm of the oppression, the pain, the struggle of all victim, oppressed people everywhere. The elements are shamefully the same, always. Some at the advantage of others, seeking security that depends on others being insecure. Seeking comfort that means others must be left out. As priest, prophet, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, deposed president of Haiti, would put it, the problem is always the same. Some believe they were called to places of honor at the banquet table of life, and that God meant for them to have their feet resting under the table, crushing the heads and the bodies of people they see unworthy to be placed there with them in honor. Dr. King was a prophet. Aristide is a prophet. But oh my God, it is so important that whether you notice that, acknowledge that, affirm that or not, that you understand and accept unequivocally today, you are a prophet. You have gifts and you have a call, and God would have you no longer try to escape that. We have in our community of faith in this parish people who have served God as ambassadors to other nations. We have people in our parish who have, with deep commitment and a sense of consecrated service, served this country in the military and in government offices. But we have as well in this parish people whose special gift is simply to be kind within their own household, touching by their example people on the same street and in the same neighborhood. We are blessed with people in a variety of professions and a wondrous variety of people not usually considered professional at all. We are a wonderful gathering of a variety of gifts. We all have in common this call to be prophets and witnesses to the truth which inspired Isaiah and had him confront the world, determined never to be silent. At the Haiti conference, it was all, in a sense, painfully replayed for me, these basic elements that are always there. I was able to notice the common denominators. Oh, how gladly and gleefully did some people feel that they could somehow or other way sweep away the challenge posed by Martin Luther King when scandalous stories were told about him even after his passing, as though somehow or other his humanity and his human frailty could cancel out the power and the inevitability of his prophetic ministry. The same thing now with Aristide. In a moment of great anger and righteous indignation, as those whose office it was to protect him were plotting to take his life, when in a moment of anger he threatened that the people who elected him might violently take justice into their own hands, that became the centerpiece of all the reports and accounts. And the fact that the very accusers were and continue now to slaughter people seems to be of little importance. The role of the prophet is so painfully, so predictably, so infuriatingly always the same. At this conference, I decided to share with the people, you might say, in a way that uniquely a priest, an ordained, visible representative of the church might make the point and point out the problem, I decided to share with them the need for us to recognize how good people in high places, both in church and state, do themselves often fail in their prophetic ministry and become not fellow prophets, but impediments in the way of other prophets. And so, knowing that sometimes the preacher must put words into deeds, I decided to do something. I know, it's a piece of recent history, that the Pope went to Haiti in the Duvalier days, and he lifted the hearts of those people to a level it would be hard for you to imagine unless you were there. A broken, oppressed people who had lived for generations under cruel dictators were suddenly tasting the wine of liberation, freedom, and dignity, partially inspired by the Pope. Why, his presence and his message on that visit to Haiti was so forceful, so powerful, that when I visited there, 4 or 6 weeks later, every person I met had to tell me about the Pope. I confess to you, my friend and brother, my fellow prophet, Father Antoine Adrian, beforehand tried quietly to get someone to persuade the Pope not to go, lest his presence seem to bless the Duvalier dynasty. And he was thrilled beyond words when the Pope got there, when the Pope dispelled his fears by confronting Duvalier and lifting the hearts of the people. Oh, it was a glorious moment for Haiti and for the church. But in the time that followed, somehow or other, the power of that message seemed to be diluted. In the first days, even the bishops seemed to have caught a new courage from the Pope. And they appeared to be ready to stand up for the poor and stop being quite so available like house chaplains to the oppressors who had been stealing the life of the poor. But we all have some experience of this. With time, your passion dims to do the bold thing, the public thing, the dangerous thing, the witness thing. And so the bishops began to back off in silence. Until now, I'm sad to tell you, there's only one bishop in Haiti who continues to this day to speak out courageously at the risk of his life for the poor and the oppressed, and the Pope. And the Pope and the bishops, both of Haiti and here, can write letters of exhortation calling people to tender solicitude for the poor and never mention the name Aristide in their exhortations. They are almost like servants of the oppressors, asking them to be kind, to let food and medicines get through to the poor. The poor in Haiti who've said powerfully they'd rather die than have their essential right to choose their own leadership taken from them. But bishops and priests continue to exhort corrupt government people and hard-headed politicians to somehow or other be kinder to the Haitian people, but they never mention the name of the president. These courageous people elected at the risk of their lives in the previous election, many of them had been slaughtered at the voting booth, and still they went out in huge numbers and elected this priest prophet, this courageous man of the poor, to be their president. And the Pope and the bishops, perhaps blinded by ecclesiastical and structural concerns, have yet to sound a mighty call, let the will of the people be honored. And so I invited people at the conference to join me, but join me or not, I decided sometimes the preacher must practice what he preaches. And so I want to share with you, hoping it will move some of you to some similar gesture. I'd like to read to you the letter I'm sending to the Pope. Dear Holy Father, the people of Haiti will never forget the dramatic day when you stood before them
and warned their corrupt president, Jean-Claude Duvalier, "Faut que ça change. There must be change." To this day, the hearts of the Haitians are stirred by the memory of your declaration of solidarity with them. "Mais moi, côté nous," you said to them, "here I stand. Where are you?" In their deafening response, "Mais nous, we're here too," they were announcing to you and the world the courageous deeds which would follow. Since that day, Holy Father, at a terrible price, paid in death and blood and suffering, they have proclaimed their passion for freedom, justice, and democracy. They have resisted a cruel succession since then of corrupt leaders, and at last overwhelmingly chose a prophetic priest to be their president. At imminent peril to their lives, they chose him, believing it was their fundamental human right to do so. Now, the small but always powerful elite, in league with the cruel and corrupt military, once again attempt to thwart the will of the people. Holy Father, the people of Haiti cannot believe that you would fail to defend their sacred right to a democratic choice, no matter how deeply you might personally disagree with it. When they look to the hierarchy of the local church, they are embittered by memories of corruption and collusion with criminal leaders, and they are scandalized by the failure of their bishops to stand with them in this moment of crisis. Holy Father, the dramatic memories of your visit to the Church of Haiti have become bittersweet. Willing to suffer and even to die for freedom, the people of Haiti long to hear your prophetic voice renewing the hope you once gave them, convinced that their right to choose their own leaders is a sacred right flowing from the freedom won for them by Jesus. They look now, Holy Father, to you with a challenge. "Mais nous," they cry, "here we stand. Côté où?" Where are you? The tragic present fate of the Haitian people is in part due to the fact that prophets all too often excuse themselves saying, "I'll do it, but not yet, the moment isn't ripe." Or, "I'll do it, but surely we could find a better way, not offend the big shots. Persuade them with friendly conversation." Oh, the excuses are countless. The ways in which we try to delay, to postpone, to avoid the carrying out of our prophetic ministry. And there are priests and bishops aplenty who will salve our consciences when we so conclude. They'll tell us, "Yes, you must be prudent. You must find the right moment. You must avoid violence at all costs," while they blindly walk through the midst of horrendous violence, of the rich walking on the poor, of the elite using people as if they were things. They seem not to notice this violence and encourage us to believe there will come a day when it can all be done, where no one will get hurt. It was that sinful message, that stupidity, that Dr. King was addressing when he wrote to fellow priests, prophets, and preachers. And it was especially, by the way, to them, fellow ministers of the gospel, who admonished Martin Luther King in his own time against his imprudence and his impatience, who urged him to wait for the right day, to find the easy, friendly, nonviolent way to get it done. It was to them that he wrote these words I thought important to repeat in today's bulletin, and worthy of repeating now aloud. We know, through painful experience, that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have never yet engaged in a direct action movement that was well-timed, according to the timetable of those who have not themselves suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, King said, I have heard the word, wait, wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with a piercing familiarity. This wait has always meant never. The question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be the extremists for hate or extremists for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice, or will we be extremists for the cause of justice? Jesus Christ was an extremist for love and truth and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. O people of God, fellow prophets, be assured, there are always people, and especially and most plentifully, people of power in high places who will tell you later will be better. That caution is one of the greatest virtues. That prudence must modify all impulses of the spirit. They do not welcome such cries of impatience as the one made by an archbishop in France one time. He said, oh, prudence, prudence. We're all going to die of prudence. Oh, no, prudence at all costs. Caution must be our watchword. Politeness and working, oh, this is a favorite, working always within the system. Never mind that the system was designed by a few to benefit themselves. Work within the system. Somehow or other, it has a sacred life of its own. There will always be voices of caution, voices of prudence, voices of wait now, later will be better. But a people fired by the spirit that moved Isaiah, the spirit that continued to inflame prophets down through the ages, the spirit that burned down deep into the being of Martin Luther King, this same spirit moves people to say, now is the moment. This is the day of salvation. I will not be silent. And I pledged. If it is my particular ministry to preach and part of your cross to listen, I pledge to you, I will more than preach. I will call myself each day to practice what I preach. And I will try to catch myself when I am using prudence or caution as an excuse. If my heart is true and my resolution strong, I will not be silent until the people of Haiti are truly free. I will not be silent until Jews and Arabs come to know that we are all sisters and brothers. I will not be silent until there is peace in Lebanon. I will not be silent until the courageous youth of China are able to feel the power of their voice and the wonder of their witness making a difference throughout the world. I will not be silent as long as there is one white person left rationalizing and denying the racism that still sickens and poisons the system in which we live. I will not be silent no matter how many black people who are tired of the struggle and want to just fade into the middle class. I will not be silent no matter how many black people tell me, you've said enough, you've been on this subject too long, move on, you make us uncomfortable, you make us feel awkward, you are putting us somehow or other in the limelight and we're tired of it. I will not be silent. Oh, please, God, it's true. I will not be silent. Pointing out injustice. Accusing oppressors. Speaking out with as much passion as I can muster for the poor, the oppressed, the used, the downtrodden, the victims who are the majority of God's children in the world in the present arrangement of things. I will not be silent until everyone has been given a fair share, a full place of honor. Yes, has been welcomed as an authentic guest of honor at the banquet table of God's marriage to his people. And I hope that my passion and my preaching, my particular gift, can be but a small spark, a little bit of fuel for you to wonder anew at what is your giftedness and how can you be part of this mighty movement of the Spirit, this enkindling of the fire of God's love, purging all our excuses, confronting us in all our escapes and all our false explanations. I pray that that Spirit come alive anew, that the fire grow brighter. I pray that together we'll be able to say, in the face of whatever is to come, that our brother Martin, Dr. Martin Luther King, said, as it turned out by prophetic happenstance, on the very last full day of his prophetic ministry, the night before he was assassinated, I pray we'll be able to say with him, we will suffer and we will die if we have to, because we believe nothing will be done until the people, may I say, the prophetic people, put their bodies and their souls into it.